This is the MagicWordPodcast.com.
Hello, this is Scott Wells with the MagicWordPodcast.com. I'm sorry. Sometimes I just tickle... myself. Yes, well, happy October. We are now into the month of Halloween and also the celebration of Houdini's death, which was on Halloween, of course, back in 1926. And all this month, we're going to be doing a little bit something different here, beginning with this week, because it's all leading up to Halloween. This month, we have five Thursdays, so we will begin today with another one, I should say, the first one having to do with something scary, something a little bit different, or having to do with the macabre or the unusual or the different. I've got a lot of different people I've spoken to in this genre, and I think you're going to enjoy what we have coming up both today and the following weeks. So to begin with, I want to tell everyone thank you for listening to the podcast and to tell you that this one is again sponsored by the Friends of the Magic Word. And I want to welcome our newest member, Philip Berukowitz from South Africa. He's been a longtime friend and a new contributor, someone who has donated. And I want to thank you and welcome you, Philip. Thank you again for listening and also especially for your financial contribution, because it's friends like you that can provide a few bucks now and again that will allow this podcast to continue. And it encourages me to keep going each week with perhaps something a little bit different, something new, and something I think that you guys will enjoy. And so, by the way, I want to mention that if you do enjoy this is something I haven't really mentioned in the past, and that is that if you go to the website at themagicwordpodcast.com, there is an area for comments. So if there's a podcast that you particularly like, or you want to leave a permanent comment there, that you certainly can. I believe over the past several, 9 years, I might have had a total of 7 comments. I mean, people will mention things certainly on Facebook and send me texts and send emails. So I've gotten a lot of comments, but really very few things that have actually continued to remain in perpetuity out on the internet in the comment area. So if you like something and you want to see your name there in print also, just go to themagicwordpodcast.com. If you have a comment to make about a particular podcast that you enjoyed, or perhaps you want to hear more from this person, or you wish I would have mentioned something else, whatever it is, that's hopefully going to be a positive comment that you can leave there on the individual blog for each one of these podcasts. And this particular week, as I said, we're going to be kicking this off. Oh, before we do that, we have been running a contest for some books that have been provided by Charlie Randall and H&R Magic Books. So we are going to wrap up this contest this week. We've been running it for the last 2 weeks, and this has been one of our most popular contests with hundreds of people who have actually replied to this, who apparently have shown great interest in wanting to get a copy, because we have 6 different copies of this book. So thank you guys very much for entering the contest and also for subscribing to our pod letter, which goes out each week as well. And I am going to announce the winners of the contest at the end of this podcast. So stay tuned at the end. And when we start to wrap this up, I will then give you the names of the people who had won the free copies of the book. Well, this week we're going to talk with David Parr, who is a very interesting individual, and I had spoken with him several years ago, and I would encourage you to go back and listen to that earlier podcast I had done when he was working the Magic Cabaret in Chicago, and he has continued to go on and trying to find different theaters where he can perform. And it's interesting the journey that he's been taking and the paths that he has been following, but keeping kind of true to what he wants to do, basically. It's not something that everybody would want to do. Each of us are unique, an individual, and he certainly is as well. And he has been looking to find the right theater for the right kind of show that he has. And he has a new show called Dark Magic. He'll talk a little bit about that, but also about how that he had decided to follow his path that he thought
he would try comedy clubs, but it just wasn't working out the way that he wanted to. And so he went more into the bizarre and the dark side a little bit, if you will. And when I say dark, not black magic or anything certainly like that. But, I'm not going to spoil it all. I'm going to let you hear it from him, because we've got a lot of stuff to talk about here this week in our conversation. And I know that you'll enjoy it. So please welcome my guest this week, Mr. David Parr, here on The Magic Word. Hello, this is Scott Wells for themagicwordpodcast.com, and today I have with me a guest from Chicago, one who I had spoken to some many years ago, and it was in context of a theater that he had up in Chicago, a show he was doing there for a long time, and it was with him and a partner that he was working with at the theater at the time, but now we get to have an exclusive sit-down with him, just one-on-one, and so please welcome my friend from all the way from Chicago, David Parr. Hi, David.
Hi, Scott.
So are you from Chicago, actually, originally? Or
no, born and raised in Milwaukee.
In Milwaukee. Well, that's not too far away.
Yeah, it was right next door, yeah. And when I was growing up, my grandparents lived in Evanston, suburb just north of the city of Chicago, so I spent a lot of time there as a kid.
In Chicago.
In Chicago, yeah.
So were you fascinated by theater when you were younger?
Yeah, I mean, theater's always been in my blood. Movies, theater, I mean, anything pretend was fascinating to me.
Right.
Books and literature, of course, but... I was in plays and stuff when I was in school.
Yeah.
So I was a bit of a theater nerd, and I was already doing shows. You know, I started in magic when I was 7, and I was doing, gigs by the time I was, 11 or 12.
And your favorite type of magic was birthday parties, I guess, at that time that you were doing?
I was working the library circuit in my hometown.
Okay.
I would do summer programs for kids at all the libraries around the city, going from library to library. And a lot of the kids in the audience were my age. That never seemed odd to me. So, by the time I was in high school, I was doing regular paid gigs and stuff.
Right.
So I kind of grew up on the stage. The stage has always felt like home to me.
Yeah, well, that's pretty cool. And then being in Chicago, certainly, it is a theatrical city. There are so many great theaters and so many things that are going on. And I think of it, always thought of it really as a magic city as well. I
mean, it was quite the hub. Back in the day, there were 5 magic shops just in the downtown area. Mm-hmm. All the major theaters had the touring show, were stops for the touring illusion shows, and then you had Shulian's and the New York Lounge and the magic bars and pubs. It was a major center for magic. And I grew up always thinking of it as a home for theater in every aspect. There's such a tradition of storefront theater there, where it's just a little black box space and people are doing shows there. And that's part of the reason why when I wanted to get a regular show going, I felt like I had to move to Chicago. It just seemed like I was going to have to cast a wide net to find a theater that was willing to partner up with me. And I didn't think I could do that in Milwaukee.
There's nothing like that in Milwaukee.
No, not really. There's not a lot of there's not that tradition of storefront theater in Milwaukee. There's community theater, and then there's this sort of big sanctioned equity theaters.
Okay.
And there's not a lot in between, in the middle ground. Whereas Chicago, there's a lot of middle ground and a lot of smaller spaces that I felt like, if I can find the right space and then a theater company that was willing to give it a shot in partnering up, I could get the thing off the ground.
And you're really looking for a smaller type of a venue as opposed to, I'm thinking like a David Seebach is in Milwaukee, wasn't that right?
Yeah, yeah.
And he does Big Illusions and needs right. really a larger stage. So that's right. not the kind of stage theater that you were looking for.
No, I was looking for a little black box space that seated maybe between 60 and 100 people.
Right.
And that way, if there was raked seating, you could do close-up magic in that space, and mm-hmm. it would still be viable. And so it took more than a year of searching to find a space and a theater company that was willing to give it a try. Because one of the things I insisted on was that I didn't want to be a renter. I didn't want to rent a theater space, because if I'm just a faceless renter who turns over a check every month, basically the theater company would just abandon me to my fate.
Right.
And I just thought, I'm going to need help to get this off the ground. So I wanted to do it as a co-production. I wanted to find a theater company that was willing to partner up and split the take on ticket sales.
Mm-hmm. And the risk too.
Yeah. Yeah. And that way everyone would have a stake in the success of the show.
Right.
And they would have a stake in its success, and I would. So they'd help. Mm-hmm. And I think that was really important. And that's the way I've done all my shows basically for the past, I don't know, more than two decades.
But it's got to be tremendously difficult to try and find someone that you're trying to sell on buying your program, basically. I mean, again, if you're going to go in and write them a check and four-wall the place, that's one thing. But if yeah. you're asking them to partner with you on a risk when they're saying, who is this guy?
Right.
Who may not have had a track record at the time, you know?
Right. Well, and part of it was, you know, back then.
Then being what year?
This was, we opened the show in 07, so right. I started searching in the year before, and I'd meet with theater companies, and they couldn't quite wrap their head around the concept of it. You know, they'd say, so it's a magic show for kids? And I'd say, no, it's a magic show for grown-ups.
Because they hadn't really seen anything like that in Chicago.
No, yeah. they hadn't. And so it was like it seemed like they couldn't conceive of why a grown-up would buy a ticket to see a magic show. Mm-hmm. So then I'd have to explain to them, oh, Chicago has this grand old tradition of magic in bars and restaurants and things like that. I had to sort of spell it all out for them to basically establish there is an audience for this.
Sure.
They just don't know where to find it.
Mm-hmm.
And so many of the companies I met with just didn't understand it and turned it down.
What kind of theaters or what kind of performers had they been working with in the past? I mean, had they partnered with others? I mean, it wasn't a new concept you were bringing to them, obviously, but why did they choose not to go with you?
The idea of a magic show for grown-ups.
Oh, they just couldn't wrap their heads around just, that particular. So, okay.
Yeah, they just couldn't. They just didn't get it.
Times have changed. Obviously, we're, you know.
Yeah, very much so. Very much so. So now it's not uncommon to see a magician do a solo theater show in a theater space.
Right.
And magic is on TV all the time.
Yeah, we're kind of in a golden age of magic, I think.
Right.
Way, yeah.
I think we're really experiencing a renaissance here,
mm-hmm.
especially in, you know, among the public. I think the perception of magic has shifted. And I think it's largely because of Penn and Teller fool us,
mm-hmm.
honestly, because I have heard lay people using phrases like close-up magic.
That's
like,
interesting.
I like close-up magic,
uh-huh.
I've
uh-huh.
heard people say to me. And when I was growing up, no one but a magician would ever have used that phrase.
Right, right.
So public awareness that there are different styles and approaches to the art of magic is becoming more common, mm-hmm. I think. So, because, you know, Fool Us has on all kinds of different styles.
Right.
So people are becoming more aware. And
well,
also
the Masters of Illusion is another show.
Right, right. And AGT to some extent.
Yeah, with Chin Lim having won the Champion of Champions. And
right,
you know, I think
right.
it really puts in the forefront.
So I think now if I were going to go out and pitch a show, it would be a little easier now.
Mm-hmm.
There'd be more better awareness, I think. And
so when you're pitching them, you're talking with the owners or producers, I guess, of the venue. Do
mm-hmm.
you find the venue first, or do you just start going out and looking for producers?
I find the venue first because, you know, I looked at lots of theater spaces in Chicago that just wouldn't work,
uh-huh.
that just wouldn't work for magic. Either there were angle problems or there was no backstage
okay.
to speak of
sure.
or no wings.
Wings, right.
There were theater spaces where just the physical arrangement of it wouldn't have worked. And so I wanted to focus on finding spaces where I felt like a magic show would be at home.
And when you're looking for that, did you actually go and talk with the producer, say, can I come and take a look at your venue? Or did you go to the
sure.
show, to shows first and say, can I check it out? Or how?
No,
did you
I'd usually call them up and just say, hey, can I schedule a time to come in and take a look at the space?
Okay.
And they were like, yeah, sure.
Right. And so you go see two or three a day.
Yeah. 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 Mm-hmm. And all over the city. And part of it was also location. I wanted to be in a spot where tourists would be comfortable.
Sure.
Getting going there,
having parking, it's not a bad part of town, all that kind
right,
of thing.
Right, right, right.
Did you look at hotels? I mean, kind of like what Dennis Watkins has done there.
No, I didn't. That's mm-hmm. one thing I did not do. And part of it is because of my background in theater. I was kind of focused on finding a theater space and
right.
a theater company
right.
that had a reputation and a PR department. To help me market the thing
okay.
at first.
Mm-hmm.
So that was part of my plan,
mm-hmm.
To not go into a space where they wouldn't know how to market a show.
Gotcha. Okay.
Right.
Yeah. So you have some criteria, I guess, kind of going into it, certainly, of what you want, as opposed to just calling, used to be the Yellow Pages, but just kind of call down the list of theaters, and then they say yes, and you go down and look at it and say, well, this is not going to work at all.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So part of it was I felt like if I partner up with a theater company that has a very good reputation, it'll lend an air of legitimacy to my show.
Mm-hmm.
And we get past the sort of resistance of, oh, this must be a kid's show.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
If I partner up with a company that's known for doing grown-up material,
right.
then that will be able to sort of, it'll help me pass that association that people sort of automatically had that it would be a kid's thing.
And when you're talking with them also, in order to try to convince them that this is, it certainly is family. I mean, the children are welcome in some venues, maybe not depending upon whether that alcohol is sold or whatever in some states. Anyhow, that do you then, I guess, show them a video, say, let me kind of give you an example of what I'm talking about and have an idea already laid out in the synopsis, or do you have like a book you could give them or a video or what?
Sure. I had some video and I also had, newspaper articles of past reviews of past shows that I could say, so they knew, oh, this guy's serious, he knows what he's doing,
mm-hmm.
so we could establish that right up front. But actually, you know, you mentioned families and stuff like that. We insisted on having an age limit when we started, and it was 13 and up.
Okay.
And the theater company said we were insane for doing that. They were like,
okay.
You know, you're going to lose ticket sales. And we were like, no, it's important to us. We will never get a reviewer from the paper coming to see our show and reviewing it if they think it's a children's show. And so we were like, we're going to set this age limit.
That's interesting. Bold.
Yeah. And I just felt like we had to do it. We had to do it in order, again, to lend legitimacy to the thing.
Sure.
And so we set an age limit of 13 and up, and it worked. We got reviewed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So eventually, you know, 5 years in, we ended up dropping the age restriction. Mm-hmm. Because it was unnecessary at that point.
You'd already achieved your goal, basically.
Right. And people, you know, regardless of the age restriction, people would still bring their kids.
Sure.
And which we didn't mind, but what we wanted to do was we didn't want a reviewer to walk in and see half the house filled with children.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And, which would just change the tone mm-hmm. of the whole experience. So that was an important thing, and we kind of had to argue for that with the theater because they thought you're losing ticket sales, you're leaving money on the table, and it was like no, I think we have to do this at first.
Well, I think that would be a difficult conversation to have because particularly that is you're now partners with them. In other words, they have a vested interest, and they're trying to tell you this is the tried and true way of doing things. We know from experience you don't know what you're doing, and for you to try to convince them, no, this is the reason why.
Yeah.
That had to be a hard conversation.
At the same time, they're a legit theater company mm-hmm. that does an entire season that's not aimed at kids. And so they understood when we said, mm-hmm. we're not going to get a review if people think this is a kiddie magic show.
Right.
So they understood.
Right. Once you had the show going, did you change up much of the show during the course of the
Well, that was run? My initial impetus for creating it in the first place.
And the name of the show, by the way, was Cabaret Magic, is that
the
right?
Magic Cabaret.
Magic Cabaret, yeah.
Yeah, and my first co-star on the show was P.T. Murphy. Mm-hmm. And he was in the show for about 5 years, and then he left, and Joe Diamond took over mm-hmm. in his place. One of the reasons I created it in the first place was because I had lots and lots of ideas for, you know, magic, new material, mm-hmm. but I had nowhere to try it. Mm-hmm. I had nowhere to test material.
True.
And to sort of, there's an evolution that magic goes through that can only happen in front of an audience that
has to be tested before the public.
Yeah, you can only go so far in the vacuum of a rehearsal room. You've got to put it in front of people, and based on how they respond, now the material starts to change and evolve.
The two things you can't practice are timing and misdirection.
Right. Well, and there's some material that you can't even rehearse alone at all. Like mm-hmm. I was doing Corinda's Powers of Darkness.
Okay, yeah.
And that's a routine where you just have to jump into the deep end of the pool and try
that's true.
It.
Yeah.
And that's the only way to learn it.
Yeah.
So
like
I was,
a Q&A also, you know.
Right.
You can't
there's another one. Mm-hmm. Right. And so I had lots of ideas for stuff like this, but I needed a place to test it. And mm-hmm. I needed a place where I could do the material regularly enough, like not once a month or something like that, but every week, so it would go through that development process very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
So that was part of the point, was to be able to swap out old material and swap in new material.
Yeah, the reason I ask that is just that I'm thinking about how that, again, theaters and theater companies are thinking, okay, we're going to bring in a play, you know, Agatha Christie's, you know, Murder in the Orient Express, whatever. I mean, it's a play. It's the same thing. It's over and over and over, and it will never change or whatever. Whereas I do see a magic show as constantly evolving and being a living thing, and because you're trying to work with the audience, and you also have people who are repeat customers, and now they want to see the same thing. I was thinking there again, let's say like Ricky Jay's 52 Assistants or mm-hmm. On the Stem, you know, when he was doing it, it was the same show.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
People were coming back for a period of time. Now, he didn't run that for you have 7 years, you said?
We ran for 10 years.
10 years, yeah. I know his didn't run that long. So perhaps he may have, if he would have gone that long, maybe tried to evolve it a little bit. But anyhow, my point is that's why I was asking if whether that you had planned on putting in new things, because I'm sure you had a lot of repeat customers who were coming back on a regular basis.
Yeah, yeah. We get people who came through, you know, tourists who would say, oh, yeah, we take a vacation to Chicago every summer, and we always come to see your show.
Yeah, that's nice to hear.
Which is great to hear. But all of this sort of led to, that experience led to my coming up with the idea for the show I did at the Chicago Magic Lounge for a year, mm-hmm. which was David Parr's Cabinet of Curiosities. And so I came up with the idea for that show while we were doing the Magic Cabaret. And the idea was I'd have this big cabinet on the stage with all these artifacts inside it and, you know, weird looking objects. And each one would have a story to go with it and some piece of magic. And there would be points during the show when people from the audience would be invited to pick which artifact we'd examine next. So then there'd be like a sort of choose your own adventure aspect to the show, and it would change from week to week based on people's choices. And
the same artifacts were in the curiosity cabinet anyhow.
Right.
But the order would change because of what the audience would select.
Right. Well, and no, there were many more artifacts in there than could fit in an hour-long show.
Understood, yeah.
And I could swap in artifacts when I wanted to and take some out as I developed new material. And I wanted to create a show that had flexibility built into it and a sort of improvisational aspect built into it. And... So I had that idea in my back pocket for years, when Joe and I decided to wrap up the Magic Cabaret after 10 years was right when the folks from the Magic Lounge contacted me and said, hey, we're building a theater.
Mm-hmm.
Pick a night of the week and the stage is yours.
That's great.
And so I said, how about Wednesdays? And also, I have this idea for a title and a concept for a show.
I was waiting for you to call. You just have to... fate and opportunity came together.
Yeah, so I pitched them the idea for the Cabinet of Curiosities.
Mm-hmm.
So I was the resident artist there for a year.
Did you leave the cabinet there the whole time?
Yeah, it just lived at the theater. And the show was never designed to travel. It was designed to just... live at a theater.
Yes.
So there was this big bookshelf with all this stuff on the shelves, and we'd just push it off the stage and into the dressing room when I wasn't there, and then push it back out onto the stage.
Mm-hmm.
So after my show wrapped there, after the year contract was up, I thought, I wonder if there's a way I could tour this show.
Mm-hmm.
And after thinking about it for a while, it was my dad's suggestion. He was like, well, you can rent office furniture. You can rent a bookshelf in any city you go to.
Sure.
And I was like, oh, you know, you're right. The cabinet itself doesn't have to travel, just the artifacts that go in it.
Mm-hmm.
So for the past year or so, I've been touring the show around. I've done it in Seattle and San Francisco and Milwaukee and Baltimore, and I'm doing it in Denver.
Mm-hmm.
Next, and then Philadelphia. For a show that was never meant to travel, it's now become a touring show.
Now that it is and has traveled, do you go into the theaters then again, much like you were before, looking for someone to partner, or now you're just four-walling each place you go?
Yeah, no, we're partnering up. Like, I'm doing the show at Theater of Dreams.
Oh, yeah. Castle Rock.
Castle Rock, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then I'm doing the show at Smoke and Mirrors
in
Philly.
Pittsburgh. Mm-hmm.
In October. And I just did it at Poe's Magic in Baltimore.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm finding venues, first of all, that are magic venues.
Yeah.
Where they already have a system in place for selling a magic show to the public.
Okay, people are coming in to see magic also.
Right, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, an audience.
You know, that changes, again, the tone of the room.
Sure, the dynamics are completely different.
Yeah, because those people are pre-sold. They're there to see a magic show.
Right.
I asked in Baltimore, how many people saw me on Penn and Teller Fool Us, and almost the entire audience applauded.
Wow. Interesting.
So that's, those people were there to see a magic show.
Sure.
And they were super fun.
Well, there are other theaters, obviously, you know, that Rich Block has Dickens Theater.
I've not been there.
Yeah, you might check that out. Of course, Smoke and Mirrors in Nashville. I'm not spoken House of Cards.
I did House of Cards last December.
Okay.
Yeah.
And when we were Magic Live, there was a gentleman who was talking about a new one called Liberty Magic.
Yes. It's in Pittsburgh. It's run by the Pittsburgh Cultural Trust. And they're looking for people to do like a 6-week residency.
Yes, correct.
At their place. Mm-hmm. And so they're looking for shows that are finished.
Mm-hmm.
I just actually sent them a pitch. They have an online application process that took me an entire afternoon to do because they want video of the show in its entirety, any marketing materials you have, all this stuff. So they're really looking for people who've they want a show that already is ready to go up and running.
Right.
And
Most part, aren't those also those kinds of shows that would be, again, like an Agatha Christie kind of thing? It's like a package show that is start to finish, and it's a scripted and everything?
Presumably, yeah. 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 And it's like a little, it's like a 60-seat house, rake seating, and so it's kind of like, that's where I live most of the time.
Yeah.
So I just sent them a pitch. I haven't heard anything back. But that would be fun. But meanwhile, I also developed another show called Dark Magic. I had approached a theater company. I'm looking for a new home in Chicago for the Cabinet of Curiosities show. And I had approached a theater there that does mainly science fiction and fantasy-based work. And I actually saw a show there, and I enjoyed it a lot. And it's called Otherworld Theater in Chicago. And so I approached them and said, would you be interested in this Cabinet of Curiosities show? And then when we started talking about it, I was like, I don't think that show will work here. It just wouldn't practically work in their theater space. So then they said, well, we'd like to work with you. Can you write another show?
Yeah.
And I said, okay, I'll do that. So I developed a show called Dark Magic that I've done there a couple of times. And it's all kind of spooky stuff.
Is that really something more? It's a Halloween kind of...
I think, you know, Halloween has become such a big thing that I think stuff that traditionally would have run only in October in the past can now run all year. Because there are people who are into paranormal weirdness.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can tap into that audience, there are so many ghost hunt shows on TV now. And... There are conventions and online groups for, you know, all this stuff, ghosts and cryptozoology and ESP and all this stuff.
Right.
And that's become so mainstream that anything that would have traditionally run in October is now a viable thing all year.
It's kind of a goth thing, I guess. From the
If you can tap into those weirdos like me, who dress in black all the time and are into this stuff and have been into that stuff since they were kids, like when I was a kid, anything spooky was my thing.
Sure.
You know, I grew up watching just loving the show Kolchak the Night Stalker. That was like my favorite TV show.
That's right.
Yeah, and you know, that was a huge influence on the folks who developed.
Wasn't he the same guy who played in The Christmas Story?
Yes, Darren McGavin.
Yeah, Darren McGavin.
Yeah, he was the Chicago reporter investigating paranormal cases for his newspaper and, you know, trying to convince his boss that this stuff was legit.
Right.
And I loved that show, and it went on to be a major influence on, like, Joss Whedon, who created Buffy the Vampire Slayer, and the folks who created the X-Files. That Kolchak was, like, a touchstone for them as well.
Yep, I can see that influence there, sure.
You know, in spooky comic books and all that stuff I was into as a kid, monster movies and all that.
Similar to me, yeah, I did
too. That's now not just a niche thing anymore. That's mainstream culture, as are comic books and all that.
Well, that's true. Yeah, there are comic cons and everything that are going on in every city, you know, all around. That's true. Yeah, when I was a kid, I too liked monster movies and grew up, you know, on Frankenstein and Dracula and the Wolfman and Creature from the Black Lagoon. And I used to get all the the magazines, you know, from the
Famous Monsters.
In fact, Famous Monsters. In fact, when I was a little kid, I thought, when I grow up, I'm going to be a a makeup artist.
It's what same
I,
here.
Yeah, what
same
I wanted here. To do.
It's fascinating. Did you really? Well, because there's a definite overlap with magic.
Mm-hmm.
It's about creating an illusion.
An illusion, true.
Right. So the appeal of that, of, you know, reading about how Frank Pierce created the, you know, the Frankenstein monster makeup, for instance, and all that, or Lon Chaney Jr. having yak hair glued to his face and all that. I mean, that sounded like fun to me as a kid.
Exactly. I had a little cigar box, and I got my mom's makeup and lipstick and everything, and I put together actually a little makeup kit that I could do a monster kind of a thing. You know,
it was a little Halloween. Lon Chaney Sr. Was, kit.
Exactly.
Awesome. That's awesome. Yeah, I didn't go that far, but you know, the first book about magic I ever owned was called Spooky Tricks. And it was a scholastic book that I got in school. They would pass around a list of books that were available, and you could order them there in school.
Is that when the book bus or the van?
The bookmobile.
Bookmobile.
That was a different thing, which I loved.
Yeah.
But this was, you know, the scholastic books you could just order from an order form in school and pay for them, and they'd arrive, and it was like, oh, it was like having a birthday every month because all these cool books would arrive, and one of them was Spooky Tricks.
Yeah.
And it was all just, it was all like magic that was guaranteed to produce horrified responses from grown-ups, which I love.
Yeah, sure.
You know, and it was like the, you know, cutting the hole in the box and
put your finger,
in there, and then you, so you've got the severed finger in the box. And, pushing pins into your thumb and eating a goldfish and
just gross things that
all this stuff. Which you know I delighted in as a kid. So you know, I realized at a certain point that there was this, my interest in magic arose in the sort of spooky territory. And then I would come back around full circle to that when I started doing Halloween shows and got interested in bizarre magic and seance stuff.
Well, when you were talking about the dark magic, I would think that would keep away some families bringing children, just from the simple
Probably. Yeah. Although, you know, kids are into weirdness now. We now live in a post-Harry Potter world. And, you know, the image of Mandrake the Magician with his top hat and his cane is not the public perception of the magician anymore.
Yeah.
The public perception of the magician is more like a wizard now.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think lay people expect magic to be a little weird. And kids, you know, when I think back to when I was a kid, I was into weirdness when I was a kid. And I think that a lot more kids are into weirdness now, now in a post-Harry Potter world. So the idea of, you know, alchemy and wizardry and all this stuff, it's all woven into those books that kids have grown up with.
I see what you're saying, but when I'm thinking of dark magic, I'm thinking of something that might be more satanic. I guess just the title.
I don't think you automatically get that association anymore.
Okay.
I mean, maybe for some people. I mean, I've occasionally encountered people who are like, no, you're doing the devil's work.
Right.
It's like, well, if I'm doing the devil's work, why am I driving a Ford Focus?
You'd have a better chauffeur.
yeah. So I think what's happened in our culture, the shift away from the top hat and tails magician and toward the wizard image, the more Merlin-esque image, has caused a very interesting shift in public perception of what a magician does and what a magician is and what a magic show is like. And I think that's part of the renaissance we're experiencing right now. And, you know, I'm out there doing magic that's a little bit weird all the time.
Okay.
So I think, you know, occasionally I run across magicians who are like, well, but there's nowhere to perform bizarre magic. And I just think they really need to do some catching up with the zeitgeist.
Good point. Because you're blazing a trail, though, I think. You know, this, like you were saying earlier in 2007, when there weren't many producers or venues who understood what a magic show is, and now people are not understanding necessarily what a bizarre magic show is.
Yeah, I think now is the time to like go out there and do stuff that's a little offbeat. And I think the public is ready for it. They're hungry for it.
Sure. And you need to relate to the audience, I think, with a story. You know, again, going back to Magic Live earlier this year, that they had a speaker who was talking about the importance of storytelling and reaching to the audience.
Right.
And I think there's nothing, you know, better than a bizarre story, certainly, to reach in and grab someone's heart and soul.
Yeah. Well, a ghost story, man. Yeah. I mean, we love those. The ghost story around the campfire is a pivotal childhood memory for a lot of people.
Sure.
And so I think to tap into that that's fertile ground for engaging with people.
Right.
And, you know, I think, you know, at first when the bizarre magic movement started, you know, with people like Tony Andruzzi and Charles Cameron and Tony Shields and Tony Raven, it was very focused.
A lot of those guys in Chicago, too.
Yeah.
Is that coincidence?
It was a very
Maybe
focused
not?
Thing. Maybe. There was something in the water.
Yeah. Now you're up there.
But it was sort of magic that had a very occult feel.
Feel to
it was very influenced by H.P. Lovecraft and William Hope Hodgson and pulp magazines from the 1930s.
Sure.
And that was, it was a deliberate sort of subversion of mainstream magic at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And now I think the definition of bizarre magic has broadened as it's become more popular and sort of entered the mainstream of magic and influenced people, influenced magicians. I think it's become a much broader thing, and I think it now encompasses what you were talking about, storytelling magic.
Sure.
And that happens with any artistic movement starts as a narrowly focused thing, and then it expands so that more and more people embrace it. And it becomes more and more an influence. You know, when you talk about impressionism or surrealism or any artistic movement starts as a sort of like a counterculture almost, and then it expands and it becomes the culture.
You know what that makes me think of is how that people want to be, all of us want to be individuals, and we want to stand out and be different from the rest. And so by doing that, you a lot of times end up being a lot like somebody else, you know, because that is something that, hey, they're a little bit different, and I don't see many people doing that. But the first person who starts doing that, whatever, quote, that different thing is, that others will start to follow. So that's what then eventually people say, oh, I want to gravitate towards that because I can color part of my hair blue, or, you know, I could have dark eyelashes or whatever it is, you know, to kind of have something that is making me stand out. You know, if I can't be the cheerleader or the prom queen or the captain of the football team or something, you know, that there's got to be something where when they're younger, I'm just saying, you know, they want to try to stand out and have their individuality.
Sure.
I said they're our, you know, each of us are trying for something. Point being is that eventually that becomes mainstream because more people are looking towards that. Same thing like with art, where that you would have Jackson Pollock, you know, or, you know, others will start to follow, you know, in this genre, you know, if you will.
Yeah.
You know, whatever was pop culture with Andy Warhol and others started, you know, following suit because, hey, that is really different. Well, I can do something kind of like that. And then they kind of embrace that, you know.
This is a great thing. I'm glad you brought this up because I went to all 7 of the invocational conventions in Chicago in the 1980s. And when I was going to those conferences, this was the conference that was Tony Andruzzi's convention every year in Chicago. When I was going to those, at that point, I was doing comedy magic, and I was performing in comedy clubs all around.
Hmm.
And I was miserable. I hated it. And I hated it because basically the game was pander or die.
Hmm.
Those people in that audience wanted something that I could not give them.
Okay.
And that just wasn't in me to give. And I was trying to do abstract humor, and it was I bombed over and over and over again. And it reached a point where I thought, I have to stop this. I'd occasionally get an audience that was on the same wavelength with me, and that would be fine. But mm-hmm. the rest of the time, I just died. And I thought, if I don't stop this, I'm going to start to resent magic.
Wow.
And that's going to be like cutting off my arm.
Sure.
Because by that time, I'd grown up with it. It was part of me.
Part of you, sure.
Yeah, it's part of who I am, not just a thing I do. So I thought, I have to stop this. And what occurred to me, I think later, in retrospect, I realized this. Going to those conferences and realizing that Tony Andreuzzi had been a successful comedy magician. You know, he did the Tom Palmer Comedy Act,
that's right,
which Magic Inc. probably still sells in Chicago.
Which later became Johnny Thompson's act.
Right. He was a very successful comedy magician. At some point, he decided enough. Mm-hmm. He abandoned that path, and he set off on this new weird path.
That's interesting.
And created Masculine Image and changed his name to Tony Andreuzzi.
Yeah.
So knowing that he had done that, just on an unconscious level, told me, oh, I could do that too. I could abandon the path that's making me miserable, and I could find a path that will be satisfying to me, and I could find a place where I belong, where I feel at home.
Mm-hmm.
And comedy clubs was not it. So that's when I started thinking about creating a Halloween show, and the place where I decided to set it was a museum, like an old house outside of Chicago that's now a museum. And my idea was to basically make it like a walk-through haunted house where the audience would move from room to room of the house, and mm-hmm. in each room a magic effect would take place, and then it would end with a seance in the center of the
That's
house.
That's a good concept. I like that.
And I thought, you know, because when I was in my teen years, I worked in walk-through haunted houses for charity every Halloween season.
Mm-hmm.
And even after I graduated from high school, I worked at there was a haunted house at the state fair in Wisconsin, and I worked at that for a number of years.
Mm-hmm.
So that idea of people moving through a space from room to room was like in my brain already.
Yeah.
And I missed that experience. So, so I found this cool place to do a Halloween show, and I left the path of comedy magic and comedy clubs, which was just making me unhappy.
Right, right. Obviously, no regrets. I mean, it was a good decision.
Yeah, no. And when I thought back about it, it was like, oh, why did this take so long for me to reach
sure.
this realization?
Of course.
Because when I looked back at where my interest in magic began, it was always spooky stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So I was like, oh, this is what I'm meant to be doing.
Yes.
Not performing in comedy clubs.
So the Magic Cabaret, coming back again to that.
Uh-huh.
I don't recall whenever I saw that show that was overtly spooky magic kind of stuff.
No. I mean, I would occasionally throw in stuff, especially around October.
Mm-hmm.
But it was more of a place where I could try almost any idea I came up with.
Mm-hmm.
Because the concept was so open. Part of the reason why we chose the title The Magic Cabaret was because it would allow us to do almost anything
mm-hmm.
under that title, and nothing would seem out of place. Like, even when our friends who were sword swallowers were coming through town, we could put them, they could do a 10-minute spot in our show,
yeah.
and it wouldn't seem out of place.
Yeah, okay.
Right?
Sure.
So we deliberately chose a title that seemed very open.
Sure, variety act kind of.
Right, mm-hmm. right. And So then I could try any idea I had, not necessarily all spooky stuff. Like, I couldn't put... Well, no, I take this back. In the middle of Dark Magic, I'm doing a very, very funny card routine.
Okay.
But and that's simply because I think you... The danger of bizarre magic is that it can be relentlessly self-serious. And there's nothing more unintentionally funny than someone who is relentlessly self-serious.
Okay.
And I think so you have to use humor judiciously to undermine that.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And give people an outlet for the giggles.
A little release, sure.
Right. So then they've got that out of their system, and you when you want to be taken seriously mm-hmm. and go venture into heavy territory, they'll go.
Sure.
And I think having that a variety of tone over the course of a show is important. And... there was, I can't remember the name of it, but on the show Kids in the Hall, do you remember the,
I do remember the comedy
Canadian
thing, yeah.
comedy troupe?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
They had a character who was like this goth master, and he had this, his sidekick, his manservant Hecuba or something like that, and I can't remember the name of the character, but he was that. He was the heavy, pretentiously gothy, self-serious guy
mm-hmm.
and it was hilarious.
Yeah.
And that's not what I want to be.
Okay.
So for the middle of Dark Magic, I put this very humorous routine in it, and it's to like, it's right before the material is going to start to get very
real
dark.
Heavy. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Leading up to a seance at the end.
Yeah.
So I think it's, bizarre magic, one of the pitfalls is self-seriousness, and I think the way to avoid that is to acknowledge the sort of absurdity of magic. Magic is a kind of absurdism, in a sense, in the sense that it's a subversion of the rules of reality.
Physics.
Right.
Nature.
Mm-hmm. Right. It's a subversion of the rules that we understand as how the world works. And that's a kind of absurdism. And I think it's healthy to acknowledge that through humor. And it gives people an outlet for that, you know, the kind of giggly stuff that you want to get out of the way if you're going to go dark.
I don't think that you could keep or maintain a seriousness for the duration of a whole show. There has to be some release, because that, again, would let that out, to let them refocus, I think,
sure.
and appreciate
yeah.
that even.
Yeah, I think it's important. Even Darren Brown, when he's entered into darker territory, mm-hmm. you know, he's got kind of a wry sense of humor.
Yeah.
There's still that aspect there that helps sell it as, well, this guy takes himself too seriously.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, it's an interesting arc about how that you kind of bring them up to a point where that then they can laugh, and then you really get into something that's like, wow.
Yeah, I think mm-hmm. once you've got people hooked in and they trust you,
right.
they trust that you know what you're doing and that you're going to treat them kindly,
mm-hmm.
they'll follow you into whatever dark territory you want them to follow you into.
Because you're presenting something in a completely different manner, that is, you're presenting a magic trick as opposed to an invisible deck, you're now having an invisible hand of mystery from beyond this, whatever it happens to be, kind of a thing. Do you use any disclaimers?
No, I don't. Part of that is just, I largely perform in theaters
mm-hmm.
where, I mean, it's just understood. You buy a ticket to see a show in a theater, mm-hmm. this is pretend, this
sure.
is make-believe.
Okay.
I also just think disclaimers are useless. I have no idea what lens people are bringing to my show. Mm-hmm. They're bringing their worldview and their baggage and their own personal experience.
Right.
And that's the lens that through which they're viewing my show. And I'm not privy to that information. So I don't know if their worldview accepts that ESP, for example, is a real thing, mm-hmm. or they believe in ghosts, or
and you're what? Not going to change their opinions,
right? That's all the baggage and sure. and worldview they bring to my performance, mm-hmm. and I have no control over that, none, zero,
right?
And in fact, I usually don't even know about it unless someone comes up and tells me something. I mean, and that's kind of one of the fascinating things about doing bizarre stuff is very often after the show, people feel permission to come up and tell their story of, I had a friend who lived in a haunted house, or when I was a kid, we played with a Ouija board and this happened.
I bet you get some interesting stories and, afterwards.
Right,
which
right.
magicians don't normally, well, magician, as you know, would come to you and say that, I remember when I was a kid, or that my grandfather, you know, used to do this or that or whatever. I
had yeah.
But that would be something that's much more personal. I think when somebody says, oh yeah, I had an instance where, you know, that my aunt came to visit me the other night or something.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. And sometimes it's a story they've never told anybody before.
Right.
Because they were afraid of seeming like a kook.
But now you are a kindred spirit.
But they seem to feel like I'm not going to judge them,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And
because you understand.
Right. And it because I'm into weirdness, obviously.
What's the weirdest story you've heard?
Yeah.
Have you got one that comes to mind?
Oh, I'll tell you about the one of the weirdest things that happened. I got hired to do a show for these people. It was a group of women who said every year they got together they knew each other in high school. They were mm-hmm. friends in high school, and every year they would get together to have a party, and it was their time to like reconnect, get away from their families, mm-hmm. and have fun. And every year they would bring in something spooky and weird because they were into that stuff.
Some physical thing.
So one yeah. year they hired a tarot reader to come
in okay.
and work the party. And another year it was like a palmistry, a palm reader. And so they contacted me because they had seen on my website about my Halloween show and they wanted a seance.
Okay.
And I said, well, first of all, let me make this clear. It's a theatrical recreation of a seance. I'm a magician. It's not a for real seance.
Right.
I'm going to use stagecraft to make the impression that, you know, the ghosts are in the room, and it's all make believe and fun. And she was like, "Oh, this sounds great." Yeah. So I got hired to do this party. I went to this party, and so we all gathered in the living room of this house and, you know, joined hands and put out all the lights, and there was a candle in the middle of the circle, and I did some magic effects and stuff like that. I did spirit slates and mm-hmm. Tapping. I have like a spirit telegraph thing where tapping sounds come from inside this box and stuff like that. And then I led into a part of the seance where what I hoped would happen, I had set up the candle in the middle of the circle to sputter and go out.
Sure.
I had drilled through the hole of through the side of the candle, mm-hmm. filled the hole with water,
right.
plugged it up with wax. Mm-hmm. So that, and I had tested it a number of times so that after about 10 minutes, it would burn down to the chamber with the water in it. The water would be released and it would sputter and go out.
Mm-hmm.
And that was going to be the end of the seance.
Yeah.
So we're all joining hands and we're deep breathing in the dark and I'm telling stories and I'm watching the candle burn down and after a while, we're past the 10-minute mark, and
wow.
the candle hasn't gone out. And and then we're at 15 minutes, and now we're at 20 minutes.
Oh, boy.
And now it's just a stub of a candle, and it's still not gone out. And I'm thinking, how am I going to end this thing? It's mm-hmm. now I don't have an ending.
Wow.
And so I thought, okay, I'm just going to have to bail. I'm just going to have to bail out and just say, okay, the seance is over. Mm-hmm. And just then, there was noise from the other side of the circle, and it was hard for me to see because the candle was between me and that person. Mm-hmm. And I was like, is everything okay? And this woman said, I don't know. I just felt so funny all of a sudden. I don't know what came over me. I feel dizzy. And I was like, oh, this is it. This is perfect.
Yes, exactly.
This is my ending. This is my excuse. So I was like, oh, we're going to wrap this up. So just sit tight. And so we went around the circle and we were like, each person would say their name and we'd say, spirits, we release you. And we go around this circle. The last person who said, spirits, we release you, as if on cue, the candle went out.
Oh, creepy.
And I thought, oh, I'm saved. So I said, okay, everyone sit tight. I'm going to go get the lights. And so I went and I turned the lights on. And people sort of converged around the woman who had said that dark. So I went over there, and this woman was deathly pale.
Wow.
And like sweating.
Like she had a heart attack almost or something.
I think she was just dehydrated.
Okay.
I think it was hot in there, and we'd been in that stuffy room for an hour, and I think she probably had almost passed out. Hmm. And so I was like, I said to the host of the party, I was like, can we just get her find her a place to lie down, get her a cold cloth for her forehead and some water. And so we took her off into another room, and as soon as she drank some water, she started to look better. The color started to return to her face. I was like, well, I'm going to go out into the party and tell everyone you're okay. And so I went out there, and everybody was like, that was the weirdest thing I've ever seen. And I was like, what do you mean? And they were like, I saw her floating above her chair. She was levitating like a foot above her chair.
Okay.
And I was like, okay. And did anybody else see anything? And this woman who was sitting across from me was like, I looked at your face and your eyes had no irises or pupils. They were just blank white.
Wow. Okay.
And I don't know if that was like reflection from the candle on my glasses or what. So then everybody had a story, a weird story about what had just happened.
That's interesting.
And everyone, it was some weird thing that I didn't plan at all. And I thought, all the while I'm listening to these stories, I'm thinking, well, if they ask me to do this again next year, I'm going to have to say no.
No.
Because I can't recreate any of this stuff.
And you can't top it either.
Right, exactly. But so then once everybody told about their experience with the levitating woman and the blank eyes and all this stuff, then started coming out all the stories about the house I used to live in was haunted. Mm-hmm. And every once in a while we'd be sitting at the table and you'd hear a voice say random words. Mm-hmm. And people would look around and there was nothing.
Yeah.
And so it was those kind of stories. Actually, the hairs on my arms are standing up right now
as you're
talking about that story, because it was super eerie. They'd be having breakfast, and all of a sudden they'd hear a voice, like not a spooky voice, just like a conversational voice, and it would be part of a sentence or just a word or two, and there was no one there.
Hmm.
And so it was stories like that. Like everyone had permission to share that kind of story.
Personal stories, right.
And I think everybody has a story like that.
Yeah.
I have a story like that. So it's a cool thing. I mean, it's a human thing.
Mm-hmm.
Like to have that kind of magical experience. I mean, human beings are magical thinkers. This is what we are.
Right.
And our brains create this kind of stuff, and it makes us fascinating creatures, you know. So it's doing this sort of spooky stuff has provided me a way to sort of collect this kind of data about people.
Mm-hmm.
And I think everybody's had some kind of weird experience. And often it's a weird experience they haven't told other people about because they're too afraid they'll be dismissed as a kook.
Right, right. Yeah. So they're now accepted. Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, as we start to wrap up, what is your website where people can find you to learn more about?
It's davidparr.com.
With two R's.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Got it. And the name of my podcast is called The Magic Word. So what would be your phrase? What do you live by? What's your philosophy of life? Not necessarily a word. It could be a...
I mean, as an artist, I think that the task is know yourself.
Hmm.
Know yourself. Who are you? What are you passionate about?
That's a lot of what you've just been talking about this whole time.
You're, right,
you know,
exactly.
From the standpoint where you didn't want to do this and didn't want to do that, but you found your true journey.
The expression of myself, yeah. Mm-hmm. Of who I truly am.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think that's part of the game,
yeah,
is to discover who that is, so then you can share it with other people.
Sure.
So I think job one, I felt this way as an actor too, just doing roles in plays,
mm-hmm,
bring as much of myself to the task as possible. And that means you have to know yourself.
Yeah. Great. A lot of really good stuff there. Boy, that was interesting. Thanks, David. I appreciate
the time. This has been fun. I could talk about magic all day long.
I can sense that. Yes, we could. Well, thank you again. So for the Magic Word Podcast, that was David Parr. This is Scotty out. Well, thank you, David. That was very enlightening. In fact, I think that was kind of like a twofer. Yeah, if you think about it, the first part of that had to do with theaters and trying to find the right theater. And I think there was a lot of good business and marketing information in that first half. And then likewise in the second half of getting to know yourself and trying to find out what you are best at and really following your path that way. So it's was really enlightening and a lot of fun. I certainly enjoyed talking with David, and I look forward to future conversations with him just kind of on the side as a friend, and I hope that you guys enjoyed that as well. And if you're looking at getting into a little bit of the darker side and do some bizarre type of magic, if you want to write him or contact him, I'm sure that he'd be glad to share some ideas and to encourage you as well along your bizarre path then too. Well, to first this podcast, I told you we were going to be drawing the names, and I will give you the names who were randomly drawn from our many people who had entered the contest for a copy of Nick Trost's Creative Card Creations, Volume 7, published by H&R Magic Books, and compliments of Charlie Randall. So thank you very much. And now let's announce the six different winners. And the winners are Rick DeNatale, Joseph Kerrigan, Carl Kramer, Mark McPhee, Matt Neely, and Daniel Will. Congratulations to each and every one of those people who have won, and also thank all of the listeners who had taken the time to go to the Magic Word Podcast and to enter the contest. We'll be having another contest coming up sometime soon. I've got some more things here in the goodie bag that have been given to me to award to lucky listeners in the future. So continue to watch for the next contest, and of course, if you subscribe to the pod letter that comes out each week, that you will find out to be the first to know when we're going to be having the next contest, and also with reminders being sent out, so this way you don't forget to enter the contest. If you're not a member or have not subscribed to the pod letter, be sure to go to themagicwordpodcast.com, and you'll find an easy way there where you can subscribe. Well, this has been a little bit of a lengthy podcast, and I want to kind of cut it there. If I have some time, perhaps next week or the following week, I've got something that I want to review then as well, but that'll be coming up sometime soon. But golly, we've got just a bunch of stuff that's going to be interesting. I'm sure you guys will enjoy all of this Halloween season of October. So until next week, stay well, get booked, and remember to know thyself and try to bring as much of yourself to the task as you can. This is Scotty out.